Welcome to the Faily Tale Show. I'm your host and curator of fails, Akash Manthar. In this show, we have conversations with our very accomplished guests about their tales of fails. Let's jump right in and start learning from the collective failures of humanity, because it's story time. Welcome to the very first episode of the Faily Tale Show. Joining us today is Girithar K.N. Giri has been a very close friend of mine for over 22 years. I've known him since the year 2000. We went to college together. He is also an expert in the field of real-time communications. He has worked on products such as Link, Office Communicator, and Skype for Business at Microsoft, and he currently leads engineering for Chime SDK at Amazon. Welcome to the show, Giri.
Hey, Akash. Well, thanks for having me on the show, and I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you here, man. We've been talking about this for a while, and it's good that you're finally here. Very, very excited to listen about some of the tales of fails that you have had over the year in such a long career. So what do you have for us today?
Yeah, there are a lot of tales and battle scars to talk about, but I guess let's kick off with one of the stories where I was at Microsoft and we were sort of tasked with building what we called as meetings in a box. And this was a new product. It was like a V1 initiative. We were sort of trying to build out a sort of hardware experience that you could place in sort of, you know, various small rooms or common area common areas where you could sort of plug in your television into this hardware and effectively enable that to be used as a place where you could take your meetings.
I see. So kind of like Facebook portals, Alexas, or like, was it different?
Yeah, it's sort of, you should sort of, I'm talking about like sort of 2014, 15 or around that time frame. So these devices didn't quite exist at that time. So we were sort of conjuring things up based on commercially available hardware like the Intel NUX, which had sort of i3 processors. And we had sort of created this hardware array of mics that would sort of go up to a certain feet of space where you could sort of have a great audio experience. So the product was sort of targeted at, you know, enterprises as well as sort of, you know, airports and lounges where you could sort of create a space for customers to come in and sort of take their meetings. And it would sort of be certified for, you know, to work with sort of the common Microsoft products that existed at that time, like Skype for Business, and effectively you can sort of bring your meetings to that device. And the primary idea was that it would be sort of an identity-less space, and you would sort of bring your identity, and for the time frame of whatever you spent taking your meetings, you would transfer your identity to that device and it would join on your behalf.
Interesting. So if I understand this correct, so I come and connect my device to this thing or connect my identity to it, take my meetings, disconnect my device and move away, and it's set up for somebody else?
That's exactly right. So it's kind of like a kiosk sort of experience. And I think that's where sort of some of the challenges came as well, like as we began developing it. And there are some good lessons that we learned.
Very curious. Like, so what kind of challenges?
Yeah. So we had spent a fair amount of time designing with the best of engineers, best of hardware engineers, you know, making it acoustically a great experience. We had come up with the best technology to sort of manage and run meetings to securely connect your device to the meetings. But the primary challenges we ran into were sort of, you know, the very first experience that the customer comes into the space and has to pair their phone or their device with what was on the screen. It was sort of analogous to how you would sort of pair your phone with a hotel device with Roku, for example, today. And there was, I think the fundamental challenge we felt is it was great for someone that was in a common area place that was visiting once in a while, but in an office setting, in an enterprise space where you're taking multiple meetings, that became a clear friction point. And that experience of, you know, looking up, typing on your phone, getting it right, pairing with that device, that experience pretty much failed like right away. And we, as soon as we put that into beta testing and started sort of driving adoption of it, we got strong feedback where users were struggling, and it was a repeated process was really, you know, driving them crazy, being able to do that. So that was one. And then the other set of challenges sort of we ran into here were sort of trying to figure out what was the right size of space that we were designing the product for. There were significant challenges here because what we found was a lot of the organizations, as we did more and more research, seemed to want to accommodate slightly larger rooms than we had planned for. And sort of, so finding the right sweet spot in terms of the average size of conference rooms in various organizations. And also that had evolved as we were developing the product. You know, organizations were beginning to build out more larger rooms than we were sort of anticipating. So that was another learning, which is to design to the right sort of where the world is going rather than sort of what you felt was there today. And other challenges we also ran into were sort of in the device management. A lot of IT organizations like to manage these devices kind of like resources that they're used to, and they don't like this paradigm shift of these being non-identity or identity-less devices. And that created more friction for them to sort of learn this new way of managing conference rooms, because they've been doing it for years together. And for us to break through that was another challenge.
Interesting. So if I were to summarize, there were like three main issues that you guys ran into. One was the onboarding experience. The second one was assumptions around the meeting size and like building for what was now and not where the companies were going. And the third one was around running into friction with the IT departments around how devices were managed historically. So you're trying to change the paradigm. Interesting. So what did you learn? How would you do things differently today? Because now we're all familiar with like pairing with Chromecast or Apple TVs and like signing into YouTube on your TV from your computer or your laptop or whatever. Like, so how would you do things differently?
I think the pairing experience, I think, has to be magical. Like if you look at the way Alexa sort of does it, they call it the golden utterance. Like it has to be the most intuitive, natural thing that you would do when you enter the space, rather than having to read instructions and you know, try and follow that. And I think the model where it is today is these rooms do have a concept of identity, and the security that we were so anxious about that nobody should join my session, and that works great for a public space, but when you bring it to an enterprise space, the products are not the same. There's a different product that you would build for like a public space versus what you would build, say, in an enterprise. So I think the enterprise is stuck to this model of being able to have an identity and to invite the room to the meeting in your calendar invite, and by virtue of being invited, it has your meeting already there, and you click on it and it connects you into that session. I think that model continued to evolve, and that's what's been working. And there's the sense of etiquette that nobody would come and jump into your meeting if you've booked the room. Whereas for the public space, I think the approach, you know, that we discussed around pairing and that model still sort of continues to work, and you see that in hotel rooms and wherever you go. So I think we're probably trying to combine two products into one is where I feel, you know, was one of the big learnings that I'd probably not do again.
Interesting. I'm very curious on the device management side too, because a lot of the software has been going from on-prem to cloud. So I'm assuming the IT paradigm has been upended anyway. So how did that one go?
Yeah, I think in terms of the devices themselves, I think traditionally they were connected to your Active Directory and you would have like a management console that you would sort of, you manage them through. I think in the new world, I think there is sort of devices are connected to the internet. Everyone's like sending a heartbeat and you have, a cloud website where you go and you have your device list and you have, you know, health of each devices. And so there's a lot of, you know, with IoT coming in, there's a lot of other technology in terms of tracking and understanding the health of your devices. So, and it's not just rooms, you have other devices that you're managing today as an IT admin. So there is a centralized cloud console that's driving a lot of this today.
Awesome. Yeah, I remember you telling me a story, which was about the challenges you had in moving the system from on-prem to cloud also. So it's not just the IT teams, but also the software teams struggled with that migration.
Yeah, so I guess if I were to talk about slightly different story, which was sort of related, but sort of the backend infrastructure that was powering these meetings for Skype for Business and at Microsoft, like traditionally we built products for as on-premise software. When originally this product was started, it was built for IT administrators to take. Like it was literally shipped on a disk, so they would install it on their boxes, and it was built for scaling out as units. So if you had X number of users, they would be assigned to a set of boxes, and you would build out more boxes as you had more users. And the general idea was that it was sort of built to scale for one organization up to hundreds of thousands of users, and pretty much, you know, it's one admin who's managing their infrastructure. And if you were to talk to other organization, you would set up some sort of peering to enable that connectivity. And then the world was sort of shifting, and customers didn't want to do all of that heavy lifting. And they wanted, you know, the cloud was becoming more popular and they wanted, you know, Microsoft to sort of take on that heavy lifting. And so, and when we initially started, we felt like, okay, we need to migrate our service, our customers to the cloud and help them with this transition. But, you know, we were an incumbent and we had customers and we had to service them. It was not like we could drop everything and tell them we're going to build a completely new product in the cloud and you should use it. So we had to sort of take them through that journey of migrating to the cloud. And our first initial idea was, hey, let's take what we've already built and figure out how to host it ourselves and run it in a multi-tenant fashion in the cloud. And that's where initially it was fine, as we had a handful of customers and we were sort of able to replicate what they would have done ourselves in the cloud and make that available to them. But as we began to scale, that's where the challenges sort of came about. Predominantly a lot of the challenges were around how we were sort of modeling sort of the data store and how we were sort of creating a backup story for these instances and how we were managing instance failures and state replication and data replication across nodes of or clusters of servers. And that's where we started seeing more and more challenges with the paradigms that we had designed for on-premise.
Got it. So if I understand what you're saying is, because you managed the hardware and the storage more closely in an enterprise space as opposed to a cloud, the architecture supported a certain kind of a pattern. But when you move to the cloud, like the stickiness of the sessions, the connection, you couldn't really rely on the server just being there or you being co-located on a certain storage or it being replicated. So there were other challenges which got introduced because you were taking things for granted, which was the paradigm before, but the paradigm had shifted from underneath you.
Yeah, it was that. And plus, we were trying to host more users per cluster, right? Because predominantly, you can't run the service the same way at scale that you're running on-premise. So you had to sort of push the limits of the server.
Interesting one, because the operational cost was something which was borne by every single company because they were just spinning up servers and running. But now you're also running the servers for them. Exactly. So you want to really pack it tightly. You want to make sure that it's multi-tenant. You can have multiple people. I see. So that's a lot more complicated. I follow you now.
Yeah. And that's where sort of the primary challenges began, is when we were beginning to sort of push the scales and we were load testing and we were trying to drive more adoption of our customers. And we had various tiers of customers. Obviously, we had the large customers who were dedicated, you know, infrastructure, and versus the smaller customers who, you know, were, you know, in more multi-tenant sort of environments. But I think the primary challenges were around, obviously, resiliency and disaster recovery. And then the whole concept of associating a set of users to a box. And if those boxes were down, we couldn't serve those users reliably until we had executed some sort of a failover. And doing that automatically and doing that in a reliable way with the right signals were quite challenging, because these products were not built for this REST API based services. These were SIP based, session based, you know, products where you had established a connection to a box. So that sort of was the challenge, and we had to sort of migrate the customers to, so we came up with some approaches where we had an interim state where we said, okay, we're going to do the storage and the state, the sort of, you would schedule a session or all of that data creation part in an asynchronous way in Azure. And when the session would start, we would sort of place it on a box and then allocate you to a pool, you know, a free pool of service, and then, you know, get you going. So that sort of was the next interim state before we finally redid the architecture and migrated to Microsoft Teams, which is now sort of a completely cloud-first distributed service that is based on, you know, Azure and the latest REST APIs and, you know, the underlying technology that comes with it.
So very interesting. So one of the learnings I can see over here is, as an incumbent in a certain area, when there are these huge paradigm shifts, there's a lot more work that you have to do because you have to shift your entire customer base over, and then you have existing ways of doing things, versus someone who is a startup like the Zooms and the Slacks. They didn't have to deal with this. I don't remember having enterprise hosted
exactly
Slack or Zoom. So you're just cloud native. And so they have an advantage over there.
And it's also all the features that they were used to. And if even 2% of the population of the enterprise was using it, it was a critical business critical feature. There were a lot of features like call park, where you would park a call, you would go to another endpoint and pick up the call or something like that. Like, those were features that probably Zoom or others didn't even care about. Like, but as an incumbent, you had to carry everybody along. And if you didn't, then the enterprise would say, hey, you know, this part of my customer base or my user base doesn't have a valid solution. So what do you do? So there is both sort of the lack of sort of, you know, there is a need for us to move everybody, and it has to be sort of a way to take everybody along or nobody along. So it's kind of that aspect as well that comes into play.
It's very interesting. So here's just a thought experiment. What would you think incumbents could do? Like, when they have big projects like this, should they also consider creating like a Skunkworks project where they start moving some of the forward-thinking customers over and then see at some point if they want to cut over, or like keep modifying the existing product to become.
It has to come down to a lot of understanding your customer base and sort of understanding what is sort of the 80% customer base. I think the 80-20 rule applies here as well. Like, what's the 80% of customer base that you could move, with the minimum amount of work, like 20, I wouldn't say 20% work, but whatever equivalent amount of it. And what you would notice is that the primary use cases builds momentum and create some sort of interoperability story for the others, and which may mean you have to do something not so great. You can't say, okay, this is new stuff, it's pristine, it doesn't work with the old stuff. So you have to sort of build a gateway and then over time create a pathway to migrate the rest of the people. I think that's sort of, in my mind, I've seen that work in the past with existing services.
Thank you so much for sharing your stories. I think they were very enlightening. There were some good learnings over there for us. Any parting words of wisdom that you may have for our listeners?
I don't know. I mean, in my sort of history, being in this field, and I think I've always had the passion to learn and look past my failures and sort of go back to, you know, the basics of knowing why I'm in this field. I love programming. I love sitting and thinking through problems. And I think taking the time to think and, you know, taking the time to sort of distill the problem down and focusing logically what would be the next logical step, rather than trying to read and trying to do what somebody else is telling you in books. Like, I think it comes back to what you think is the right logical step and what's the most intuitive thing. I think that's ultimately that's what programming is about. And I think keeping that passion to learn and move forward. That's why I love the show. Like, it's about learning and moving forward.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one of the things I've learned about Giri over the years is Giri is someone who's a great person, but he also focuses on his strengths and he keeps building up on his strengths. He doesn't necessarily try to fix every single weakness that he may have. He's like, hey, this is my strength and this is what I'll keep working on to build a bigger gap, right? If you keep trying to address all of your weaknesses, you might come at par with everybody else on that side, but then you're also like letting go of your advantage. If you keep building on your strength, like you could get to places like Giri did. So,
yeah, and I think that we should, like, I think go back to what you love and what you're passionate about. And for me, it was programming, and that was my strength. And, you know, that's what I kept pushing hard on.
Thank you so much, Giri, for your time.
Thanks, Akash. It was great doing this.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Fairy Tale Show. Until next time, keep learning.